Well, I mean, you could never tell what strategies might work for an entrepreneur. It might make sense to sell at a loss to some markets. I mean, it's called a loss leader. But of course, there's nothing wrong with price discrimination in general. It's just that it's difficult to get away with. Just like it's difficult to have a cartel. There's nothing wrong with cartels or with monopoly, with attempts to monopolize or collude. It's just that it's difficult to get away with a cartel because there's competition and there's cheating, right?
I am today accompanied by Stephen Kinsella. He's one of the most famous and well-known proponents of the Austrian School of Economics. He's done very important work on economic theory and also patent. And you've been, Stephen, one of the biggest advocates against patents and copyright, which is exactly what I'm looking forward to talking with you about. And so, yeah, how is it that you came to think about patents and something negative to begin with?
Well, yes, I am a retired attorney in America, in Houston, Texas, and I have been a libertarian since like high school, so all my life. I never really looked at the patent or intellectual property issue too closely. I originally assumed that the standard pro-intellectual property position of like Ayn Rand was correct, although it never quite made sense to me because I never understood how you could have a finite, like a right that expired, you know, like patent and copyright expire. I didn't quite understand that, but I let it alone. But when I went to law school and then when I started practicing law in 1992, I started initially in oil and gas law in Houston, but then I switched pretty soon after that to patent law because I was an engineer. So I thought that would be better for my career. So I switched to that. And right when I switched to that, I started studying the patent bar. And also I was starting to write in libertarian legal issues at the time, like rights theory and that kind of stuff. So I thought, well, since I'm learning a lot about patent law as a lawyer, and I'm starting to write on libertarian theory, I should maybe take a position on the intellectual property issue. So I thought I would study it and come up with a better argument for intellectual property than Ayn Rand had done. Like I thought maybe she just didn't know it well enough to come up with a good argument. But the more I studied it, the more I finally realized that the reason I was failing and Ayn Rand failed and everyone else failed to justify it is that it is like literally unjustifiable. It's like incompatible with property rights. So right around the time I started practicing patent law and passing the patent bar in 1993, 1994, I also came to the conclusion as a libertarian that intellectual property is totally incompatible with patent and copyright. And understanding that issue helped to deepen, it actually required that I deepen my understanding of the basis of property rights in general from a libertarian point of view, like to disentangle that issue, which was confused by almost everyone who approached it, required me to think deeper about the nature of property rights in general. So coming to my conclusions on intellectual property forced me to, I think, become a better libertarian thinker and to rely more on the work of Mises and Rothbard and Hoppe and people like that.
You are one of the most dangerous people to make a case in this industry because being a relative outsider to it, you came with fresh eyes and you think about it from first principles, which is exactly the kind of approach I really like. You also mentioned that the property is incompatible with ideas, because in your book Against Intellectual Property, you mentioned that property only relates to things that are limited. If you can replicate a refrigerator or a lawnmower, there's no sense by which we have to address who gets to enjoy the benefits of it when you don't lose any of it by me learning about your ideas. So this is defining property is something very necessary. How do you even approach this from first principles?
Right. And so, yeah, my approach, I was always drawn towards like originally Ayn Rand, but then later other thinkers like Rothbard and others, but her principled approach to matters. Like the basic approach is one of individual rights, like realizing that the only way to violate rights is through the use of physical force, right? That was what the non-aggression axiom or non-aggression principle is about. I mean, Ayn Rand had a character in Atlas Shrugged say, or John Galt say, no man may start or initiate the use of force against another. And so that if from the beginning, that highlighted in my mind the importance of principles, libertarian principles, and distinguishing it from right and wrong. Like, so we strictly say that some things, it's not enough to be wrong or immoral to be outlawed. It has to be a violation of rights. And the only way to violate rights is to commit force. Now, that implies, without saying directly, but it implies that the things that property rights apply to, or that rights apply to, and all rights are property rights, the things that rights apply to are physical things, because you can only use force against a physical thing. Force is a physical thing, right? It's physical force. So that's sort of buried in there. So I was looking for a more precise understanding of rights, which are property rights, to solve this issue about intellectual property. Now, as I said, I came to it from a generally pro-IP point of view, but as an outsider, but as a patent attorney. Now, I have heard over the years, and I heard at that time, the typical arguments given by the mainstream and by other patent lawyers. Of course, 99% or more of patent attorneys would say they're in favor of patent law, just like most school teachers who work for the government schools would say they're in favor of government schools, and most people who get Social Security payments or welfare or socialized medicine in Europe, they're in favor of that too, because they get things, but that's not really an argument for it. So I've heard all these arguments, and I've heard the utilitarian arguments as well, the consequentialist or utilitarian arguments. And to me, those just didn't make any sense. I wanted to get to the root of the issue, and so it required that. Now, you talk about scarcity and things like that. I saw this right away when I started looking into the issue, because that concept of scarcity is part of the economic discussion. Well, economics talks about scarcity. That's what it's concerned. Economics, Austrian and others, the concern of economics is the study of wealth. Like, how do humans produce useful things that we need to survive? That's wealth. It's the study of wealth and human interrelations and production. So that's what economics studies. And it's, of course, got to do with the subject of scarcity, which is just things in the world that are not in plentiful supply. Like, if we lived in the Garden of Eden, as Hoppe talks about, then you wouldn't have any problems. You wouldn't have to do anything. You wouldn't even have to act, because everything would be provided to you all the time. But that's not the world we live in. The world we live in is a world of challenges and difficulty and uncertainty. And to survive, we have to achieve things. We have to act. So the more I thought about this issue, it became clear to me that the economics of Mises, which is, he calls his praxeology, the science of action, the logic of human action. Praxeology studies that the implications of the fact that we act and what it means to act. And economics has tended to focus on one part of action, which is scarcity. But there's a second part, and that's knowledge, because it's impossible to conceive of human action or a human actor without having to face scarcity in the world and having to use scarce resources to survive, that's tools or means of action, but also having to be guided by knowledge. You have to have knowledge about what your ends are, what you're trying to do, the laws of cause and effect, what things are possible to do in the world. So every time you have a human that acts, he has to employ scarce resources or possess or use them. That's things in the world like food and land and tools. And he has to use knowledge at his disposal that guides his actions. So those two things are both important to human knowledge. Now, the thing about human action, it employs scarce means or scarce resources. When we say scarce, we mean it's a type of thing that your use of it, it can't be used by someone else at the same time. Like, it excludes other people. It's excludable, or it's rivalrous. You might say in economics, it's rivalrous. For those types of things, you need to possess or use these resources as a human actor, even if you're Crusoe alone on an island, okay? But when there's other people around, there's a potential for conflict, because these things can only be used by one person at a time. So if there's other people around, yeah, you can benefit from their company, you can learn from them, you can trade with them, you can be in society with them, but they also, because they have free will, they might use your resource without your permission and take it from you, which prevents you from using it because of its nature. So conflict, the possibility of conflict emerges in society which impedes the ability to possess and use resources. So for this reason, property rights are normative rules and laws that emerge in society that allow us to use resources or possess them and to be secure in this ownership because there's property rights that protect you. So that's the reason for property rights. Property rights are a practical human convention that allows us to use the resources we need to use to possess without conflict. So we can live with each other without fighting, without squabbling, without rivalry, without without war, and to peacefully trade with each other instead. Okay, so that's the purpose of property rights, is to solve the problem of conflict over the use of these excludable resources. But it does not apply to that second part of human action, which is knowledge, because knowledge is the pool of ideas, which Hayek calls the fund of experience, that grows over every generation and every day, actually, as people come up with new knowledge about the world, understanding of causal laws, understanding of physical processes, and recipes, Rothbard calls them, which are ways of doing things that are more efficient. Okay, so over time, we have a greater and greater pool of information we can draw on to inform or guide our actions. And that's why we're richer than past generations, because we have more knowledge at our disposal. So the knowledge keeps improving and expanding, but that knowledge is not a scarce resource in the same sense that a table or a car or an animal or a piece of land or a piece of food, you know, or a tool is, or even our bodies, because any number of people can use the same resource at the same time. I'm sorry, the same recipe or the same knowledge at the same time to guide their actions without coming into conflict. So it just doesn't make any sense to apply property rights to ideas and knowledge and information. It only makes sense to apply property rights to the things that property rights were invented to deal with, which is the problem of conflict over scarce resources. So that's once you realize that, then you start seeing that the attempt by the law to grant property rights in ideas always fails and leads to more conflict, because you actually cannot have a property right in an idea. Property rights are always backed by physical force, and they always only apply to a physical resource. So whenever you see an intellectual property right, like the patent law or the copyright law in the Western world and in the whole world now, because of the IP imperialism of the United States and the Western world forcing every other country to adopt these laws, they're common around the world now. These laws are always really just disguised transfers of control to scarce resources. So there's really no such thing as ownership of information. So when you have a patent right or a copyright, it's called property rights and information, but that's really not what the right is. That's just the reason you do, the reason the states pass those rights is to give a monopoly control to the person who comes up with a pattern of information that's useful. But it's done by giving them the right to control how other people use their own resources. So if I have a copyright, I can go to court and get an order directing physical force against you to not use your printing press to print a book in a certain, you know, that has a certain pattern on the pages. Or if I have a patent, I can get a court order to stop you from selling, to rearranging your own materials in your own factory to make a product that looks too similar to yours. So that's really what copyright and patents are. They are negative servitudes, which is a type of property right. And the problem is that they're not consented to by the person that they burden. So that's ultimately the problem with patent and copyright, is that they restrict and they take away, and they're theft of property rights in scarce resources.
Yeah, the whole purpose of property rights was to avoid the conflict by having an algorithm to follow of who has the right to do something. And our primate evolutionary instinct of something that we have that's valuable, we have to protect, and this is mine, not yours, I'm going to territorially defend it, doesn't apply to ideas, because they replicate easier, or they do replicate, not as a lawnmower, you cannot replicate it at zero marginal cost. And so depending on the marginal cost, you have to account for that in the restrictions that we apply to it in our conventions of who should have what. It's always about the margins. There's this book by Tyler Cowen, The Margin of Revolution. So I think that the insights about the marginal analysis are very useful here. It always relates to the marginal cost of replication, I think. And so tying this back to to the intellectual monopoly and patents. How about the pharmaceutical industry is something that a lot of people have already brought up to you and said, well, how about things that require $2 billion to invest to begin with and don't have anything guaranteed behind them of having a profit, and it can be easily copied.
Yeah. Well, so if you think about people like Tyler Cowen, I think he and others, they might be a little bit skeptical of the excesses of the patent system and the copyright system, but they're not really. So they're correct that marginal analysis applies to those, but they see that as a problem because they want there to be an incentive to produce goods that are going to be underproduced because of what basically they view as market failure. So they basically think that in the material tangible world of tangible goods, you know, there's natural supply and demand limits on that. And you're able to recoup your costs, they call it, by selling these things at a profit. Even though you have to compete with other people, the competition from other people is not so easy, because if I start selling a product like a new mousetrap or something, or a new iPhone, and it's popular, I can sell it at a profit for quite a while until finally my competitors start catching up to me. But it takes them a while to hire employees and to come up with to build a factory and to compete with me. So competition always is there, but it takes a while. But in certain types of things that you sell for profit, like services or ideas or things that where the value is mostly in the patterning of the thing, like a book, then pharmaceuticals. It's said that it's easier to compete with the producer of those things because you don't have to, it's actually not quite true. I mean, it's not so easy to come up with a pharmaceutical drug to compete with one of the big companies, even if there were no patents, because it takes a while to know who to compete with. But the point is, the economists, they kind of want to have it, but they're not against patents and copyrights. So they see it as a problem that the marginal cost of reproducing is so low, because it means it's impossible to stop competition and to recoup your costs. So that's why they come up with these patent laws and these copyright laws to intentionally make it harder to slow down the diffusion of these ideas. When remember, the reason the humans are richer now is because we have the ability to use these scarce resources in the world according to our ideas. And because the sum total of ideas that humanity has developed over the last 10,000 years keeps growing, we have more and more ideas we can use, right? So when you have people learn things from each other, that's actually a good thing, right? So it's a good thing that we transmit ideas from one generation to the next through writings and through books and things like that, and stories and lore. But it's also good that when you have competition, because if I see someone competing, making a product that is successful with the customers, I'm learning from that. I'm learning that, oh, this is how you satisfy customers. So I'm going to start emulating what he's doing. And that's called competition. Normally, free market economists are in favor of that, but they don't like it when competition is too easy, right? So they want to make the market for selling intangible goods and things that are based upon patterns of information, they want to make that similar to the world of scarcity. Now, remember, the world of scarcity is not a bad thing, but it's not a good thing either. It's just the world we live in. It's because that we live in a world of scarcity and not in a world in the Garden of Eden that we have a continual challenge in life, that we're always trying to overcome the fact of scarcity. We're always trying to overcome the difficulty of living and to have more and more efficient production techniques to overcome this scarcity. So the better we're able to do that, that's a good thing. And that's why more information is good. It allows us to be more efficient in what we do, right? So it's actually insane to try to say, okay, the scarce resources that are one part of action, the means of action, are naturally limited by the fact of the world. That's what we have to overcome all the time in our action. But knowledge is not. It's totally unlimited. So let's apply the same types of rules to that with patent and copyright law to try to slow down the diffusion of these ideas to make it more like the restricted supply of material goods. It's crazy that we do that, because that's the reason that we're richer than we would be. So all these guys are in favor of an expanding field of knowledge, but they don't want it to expand too fast. So what this means is that since we've had modern patent law since around 1800 or so in the US and in the Western world, it has acted as a drag on innovation. So it's basically I mean, if you do a calculation, it's impossible to know for sure what the world would have looked like today if we had had a faster accumulation of technological knowledge. Probably trillions of people or billions of people have died, but that would not have died, you know, or we would be far richer than we would have been. It's hard to know, but we know that when you slow down innovation and when you slow down the spread of knowledge, then you slow down spread of ideas. Now, for pharmaceuticals, what people say is this. They say that they don't like to put it this way, but ultimately what everyone believes in is, even if they're free market oriented, if they believe in the patent system, for example, what they really believe is that the free market is generally good, but it's not perfect. And sometimes there's market failure. And market failure means that in certain types of fields, like public goods, like roads and defense and police, there will be an underproduction of these resources if you don't, because of holdout and free rider problems. Like this is Richard Epstein's view and other minarchist views. So the government has to monopolize and treat these as public goods and provide them by taxing people and coercing them to be part of it. So similarly, people say that, well, with a good as a tangible good, okay, the market works pretty much fine, unless there's a monopoly, in which case we need antitrust laws. So they're in favor of antitrust laws. So the state can step in, even though the state is the biggest monopoly, and the state can use this antitrust or competition law to regulate the free market, which has no real monopolies unless the state grants it. But which they do, by the way, by granting patent and copyright. But in any case, which is another thing, the state is schizophrenic, because here we have the state has the real monopoly, and they use antitrust law to go after free market monopolies, which are not real monopolies, at the same time that they grant patent and copyright monopoly grants. I mean, patents emerged from the Statute of Monopolies in England in 1623. I mean, it was called the Statute of Monopolies. That's what it was. It was a grant of monopoly privilege to help the guy that got the monopoly from the king, the patent grant, stop competition. I mean, it was anti-competitive from the core. That was what it was about. So ironically, you have the state, which is the biggest monopoly, aiming its antitrust law and its competition law at free market monopolies, which aren't real monopolies, but granting them patent and copyrights, which allow them to have some actual monopoly power, but then going after them with their antitrust law by saying, now you're abusing your patent copyright because so we give you something that helps you achieve a monopoly, but now we're going to punish you for it because you violate the antitrust law. So it's a schizophrenic, the whole thing is totally schizophrenic. In any case, what they say is that the free market breaks down because for goods that are too easy to replicate, because the primary bulk of the value of the good, like a pharmaceutical, is in the pattern of it, the information embedded in it, like a book too. Things that are easy to copy. If it's easy to copy, then it's too easy for a competitor to compete with me. And if it's too easy for a competitor to compete with me, then I can never recoup my R&D investment that I had to use to come up with that good in the first place. So I would never do it in the first place. So they say there would be an undersupply of innovation or an undersupply of new drugs and new pharmaceuticals because no one would put the money into it because they can't charge a monopoly price for long enough to recoup their costs. So enter the patent system. A patent system gives you protection for about 17 years from competition. So you can spend a lot more money to come up with a drug knowing that you can charge a monopoly price for 17 years. So you can charge, $20,000 a month for this diabetes drug for 17 years. But when the patent finally expires, now free market competition enters and there's generics and the price goes to $10 or $100 a month. And you have to, you don't make your monopoly profits anymore, but you made monopoly profits for 17 years. And that's enough to justify a big investment in the beginning. Now, why these guys don't think that, well, if 17 years is good, there must be some drugs that are not made because you still can't recoup the cost in 17 years. You need 30 years to recoup the cost. Like, so there's still some innovation left on the table, right? I don't know how they have the optimal patent term. They don't have any answers at all. But the problem with this whole way of approaching it, there's so many problems with it. Number one, one reason costs are high for pharmaceuticals is because the whole process is heavily regulated in America by the FDA. And the FDA has this extremely elaborate and expensive process for getting a drug approved. which is why it costs these billions of dollars to get a drug developed in the first place. So you have a state program which imposes extreme costs, and then the state says, well, because we've put these costs on you and now it's hard for you to recoup your cost, we're going to give you a monopoly that lets you stop competition for 17 years. So it's like one, as Mises said, controls breed controls, right? If you didn't have the FDA process, costs would be much lower. As a second thing, the FDA process requires companies to spend years getting the approval, and they have to release all their information. So by the time they get their approval, all their competitors waiting in the wings already know how to make the product because the original company has been forced to reveal their trade secrets. So if there wasn't an FDA requiring them to reveal their trade secrets, then they could go to market as soon as they wanted to and without such cost, and they wouldn't have to reveal to competitors how to compete with them. So it would take longer for someone to know, oh, here's who I'm going to compete with, because there's 1,000 drugs coming on the market. You're not going to compete with all of them because it takes money to gear up to compete with someone. You have to wait and see which drug is popular and which one works and which one is popular, profitable. So in that 1, 2, 3 year window, the first company's making quasi-monopoly profits because they don't have any competitors. So the natural free market system has been circumvented by the existence of the FDA. So that's one part. The second fundamental problem is that this whole way of looking at it assumes that the state is competent and benevolent, and its job is to allow the free market to operate, but to be on the lookout for market failures and to step in and gently correct these free market failures with the wisdom of the government. And of course, we know the government is incompetent and corrupt and can't. Its goal is not to correct market failures. Its goal is to extract rents and to exert control over the economy. And even when it tries to correct a problem, it overcorrects or undercorrects. I mean, how do we know that the patent term should be 17 years? I mean, the copyright term is now about 150 years, roughly. It's the life of the author plus 70 years or 50 years in different countries. It used to be 14 years. Why did it go from 14 to 150? Which is the right term? Can we trust the government to make that decision? So the idea that even if there are some occasional market failures, that the state should be empowered to go in and fix it is just absurd, because they're not going to do it right, and they're wrong anyway, right? And then the more fundamental problem is it assumes that the purpose of law and the state is to maximize some desired good that we just assert is the thing we want, the quantity we want to optimize. Like, we just say that we need to have more innovation in society, so we need to adjust the law to give the right incentives. The more principled approach is to say the purpose of law and the purpose of the state, if the state exists, right, is to identify and protect property rights, and then let people just live in peace with their property rights respected. Like, that's the whole purpose. And the property rights basically are very simple. The owner of a resource over which there could be conflict is the person who got it first, or who got it by contract from a previous owner. That's it. Those two core principles are the basis of all Western law, right? Plus self-ownership of your body, right? But if we're talking about external things, it's the first person to use it. That's Lockean homesteading, right? Or original appropriation. And the reason that's the core principle is because, remember, all human action is the possession and use of a resource. And of course, that means that someone is using a resource that was at one point never used and unowned by anyone. So it has to be based upon first use, right? So whatever normative property rights system you're going to come up with to reduce conflict has to assume that there is a first use of a resource, and that has to have priority over every other use, because if you don't let people use things, the human race dies out. And if the second guy gets it, as opposed to the first guy, then that's no different than just a war of all against all. So it's obvious, it's like Mises' regression theorem for money. Like, when you trace the value of money back to the first use of money as an indirect, in indirect exchange, before it was just use value only. It's almost like a regression theorem idea about property rights. Property rights, if they're normative and legal property rights that reduce conflict in the use of resources, has to ultimately rest upon the right to be the original appropriator of an unowned resource. So that's the key. And that's always got to be part of any civilized working practical property rights system. And it always has been. And then the second principle, which is subsidiary to that, is contract. It's like, if I own it, I can give it to you. I can give it to you as a gift. I can sell it to you in trade, or I can abandon it and then someone else can get it. Like, these are very simple rules that determine who owns a resource. So within, once you have such a system established, then there's free market competition, and then people have security in their possessions and their ownership of these possessions, and then they can innovate. They can decide how much of their resources to innovate, but they're going to face competition. Anything they sell, they will face competition. So the fundamental point is that intellectual property advocates think that there's a fundamental difference between competition for ideal type goods related to ideas and other types of goods. But there's not. Everything's a spectrum. So just because it's harder to make a profit selling a good like a book than it is selling a mousetrap, all it means is that you face competition sooner, perhaps, and you have to come up with a more creative way to make a profit in the face of that competition. And it's not up to the state or the legal system to tweak the rules to improve, to incentivize innovation. What they should incentivize is people not violating property rights, and so people can operate knowing that their property rights are secure. Like, that's the fundamental way to look at this landscape we have of patent rights and copyrights, which mess up the entire property rights system that we would have in a free market economy.
I love how you put it. It's arbitrary at so many levels. The length of the copyright or the patent is arbitrary. There's no justification behind it of any type, but there's also an arbitrariness to the type of patents. You cannot patent theoretical or laws of nature, theoretical inventions or laws of nature cannot be patented, but the practical application of it can be patented. How do you justify the difference? No clue. Why do we want more innovation of practical things and less of theoretical laws of nature type things? It doesn't make any sense wherever you grab it from, if you start to think about it a bit more. But I think that your argument was, the way you finished the argumentation, I'm fully in line with you. And the beginning, you mentioned that it is not the case that in the pharmaceutical industry, things cannot be copied or can be copied at a small marginal cost. But, okay, let's say that's the case, that it's very difficult to replicate. But what if it was the case that something was easy to replicate by reverse engineering, and it took a lot of resources to do the innovation? And I'm not necessarily talking about the pharmaceutical industry. I'm just giving a theoretical, the same way that everything is a matter of a spectrum. What if there was something that was very difficult to innovate, but very hard, very easy to replicate?
Then it's not worth doing.
Okay.
I mean, it's like saying, well, what if we want to go to Mars, but it's just so expensive to get to Mars, no one can ever make a profit getting to Mars. So the only way we're going to get to Mars is that the government taxes everyone on the Earth, and we come up with $75 trillion to build a spaceship that finally gets to Mars. Okay, that's true. That might be true. But that's just because you made the arbitrary goal that we're assuming that more important than anything else in human life is that we get to Mars at the expense of everything else on the Earth. Okay, but the goal of law is not to make sure we get to Mars, right? The goal of law is to do justice. And you do justice by identifying what people's rights are, which are property rights, and by protecting them. That's it. I mean, so what these people do is they say innovation is good. And they're correct that innovation is good considered abstractly, right? Artistic creativity is good. Charity is good. Productivity is good. Efficient. All these things are good, but they're not unanchored to the world. You can't just say, because innovation is good, more innovation is always good, no matter what the cost, mm-hmm. right? Because, like I said, the model of the pro IP, and by the way, I think they're totally wrong. I don't think they're correct that without the patent system, you would have too few drugs. Even with the FDA system. I think if you got rid of the FDA, certainly you wouldn't have too few drugs because the cost would be so much lower. But even with the FDA, that's still not a justification for the patent system. I've written an article where I came up with like a compromise, not a compromise, but like a non-radical, like just a reform you could do that would not be abolition. And my reform proposal is this. If you insist on having an FDA system, right, which is regulatory control of the system, which does, let's assume that it makes it harder to recoup your costs if you face competition from generics without a patent. Like, I don't think that's correct, but let's assume that they're correct, that the existence of the FDA means that you need to have a patent system. Otherwise, no one will make these drugs. Okay, let's say that's correct. Well, you still don't need to grant a patent. What you could do is you could say, because right now the way it works is the FDA says we only allow you to make the drug if you pass our regulatory process, right? And then what happens in today's world is that at the end of the patent, the generics are ready to go because they know what to do because they've had 17 years to get ready. And then they apply for a follow-on or whatever it's called. They apply for a license from the FDA to make a generic to compete. And they can get it pretty easily because all the studies have already been done by the first guy. If you didn't have a patent, then presumably as soon as the first guy got his FDA approval, then someone else could say, okay, I want to apply for a license too. So what you could do is you could have the FDA say, okay, the first guy spent $1 billion getting his approval. So the second guy, we're going to give you a license to compete with him if you pay for half of what he paid for. And then if a third guy wants to come in, he's got to pay for one third and share that with the first two. That would be a simple way to get rid of the whole objection to not having a patent given the FDA system. But no one cares about that because they want to keep the patent system going. So that's just one idea that you could, if you really wanted to, and that would highlight the problem is the FDA system. And then you could say, well, maybe we should get rid of, or maybe we should reform the FDA. Yeah, maybe we should.
So that's the argument of let's allow justice to exist, even if the world ends, but probably the world won't end because do we need to go to Mars?
Well, that's the point. I mean, you could come up with scenarios where, you know, there's an asteroid heading towards the Earth, and if we don't band together to stop it, then all life dies. And I suppose you could come up with some scenario, but that's a scenario where libertarian rights don't even apply, where peace is not even possible, and where it's either survival or not. But I mean, you can't. So this is the other thing. I've collected everything I could on this there on terms of empirical studies. So there's the natural rights argument for intellectual property, and there's the empirical argument. The natural right argument is basically the idea that if you create something, you're the owner of it, okay? That whole thing is a fallacious argument rooted in a mistake made by John Locke in his argument for homesteading. I won't say it's a mistake, but it has led to a mistake. It's an extra step in his argument that's unnecessary, but everyone is seized on that. And that the step is this. He said that the reason that you are the owner of a resource that was unowned and that you homestead is because it was unowned and you mix your labor with it. And you own your labor, and therefore you own the thing you mix your labor with. Okay. That argument is needlessly complex, as David Hume realized and pointed out, because it rests upon the assumption that you own your labor. And if you own your labor, you own something that you mix your labor with. But you don't need to make that assumption that you own your labor to say that you still own the resource you homestead, because you own the resource you homestead because you're the first one to use it. It's not because you own your labor. In fact, you don't own your labor. Labor is an action that you perform. It's one of two actions you can perform. There are two types of actions. There's labor and leisure. Just like there's consumer goods and consumption goods. They're just two types of goods. And there's two types of action, labor and leisure. Leisure is what you do that you want to do for its own sake, and labor is what you do to acquire the thing to make it possible to have leisure. But they're both actions. They're both the employment of means aimed at an end. So why would you say you own your labor Does that mean you also own your leisure? What does that even mean? In fact, what does it mean to own your action? Action is what you do with the things you own. The things you own are your body and the resources you employ. So this idea that you own your labor is a metaphor, which is a way of saying you don't have the right to hit my body, which is saying I own my body. But when people took it literally, this led to the labor theory of property of John Locke, this idea that we own our labor because we own our bodies. And that led to the labor theory of value of Adam Smith and Ricardo, and then Karl Marx and Marxism and communism. And that idea is still around today when you hear people say, you're entitled to the fruits of your labor, right? Which is the idea behind patent and copyright law. And it's also in the idea that you own whatever you create, because they think that creation is a source of rights, because they're thinking, but they're wrong. The Lockean homesteading idea is not about creation. It's about claiming an existing thing in the world. So there's these unowned resources in the world, like land and animals and trees and fruit and food. And they're not used, and someone starts using it, they possess it. They don't create it, they possess it. And in a society that recognizes the first user has a better claim, now they're also the owner. But they're not the owner because they created it. They're the owner because they embroidered it, and they established an objective link between themselves and the thing. They establish a connection that can be recognized socially, right? But the point is that embroidering or that homesteading activity is not creating, it's possessing and homesteading. It's occupying, as the Romans would say, right? So when people say you own an idea because you created it, they're assuming that ownership, they're assuming that creation was a source of ownership, but it had nothing to do with ownership. Right, it never did have something to do with ownership. What they do is they're mistaking the case, the understanding of the creation of wealth with property rights. So property rights emerge as a response to the problem of conflict, and they're assigned according to whoever has the best connection to the resource, which has to be the first user, right? It's the first user, not the creator, the first user. But wealth, it means valuable or useful capital goods or consumer goods. They're useful because they're useful in human action, right? But wealth means rearranging something that you already possess and own into a more useful configuration, right? So wealth is not a tangible thing that you own. Wealth just means that you prefer the way something is arranged, right? So when people say, and they're right that labor is a source of wealth because you have to labor on things and use your intellect and ideas to more efficiently rearrange things that you own into a more useful configuration. So when you have ownership of a thing and you transform it or you rearrange it, that's called production. That's what economic production is. It's rearranging things. So you call that creating, but you're not making a new property right. You're just rearranging something you already owned, right? So if I come up with an idea that allows me to more efficiently rearrange these things, that idea is useful because it guides my action. And you could say I created that idea, but it doesn't mean that I've made anything new in the world that is ownable, right? It's just a pattern of information that guides action. So this is the fundamental mistake, is the Lockean mistake of thinking that we own our labor. I forgot what got me on this tangent, but you asked something that made me rant about labor.
If there was a hypothetical low marginal cost of replication, but a very high marginal cost of creation, how would that relate?
So it's about creation, right. So, and like I said, the short answer is, if you can come up with a hypothetical about the creation, a certain action or a certain productive activity that is not profitable, what does economics tell us? That's how entrepreneurship works. You have a human actor, and all action is entrepreneurial in a sense, because all action is always aimed at the future, which is uncertain. And it always employs scarce means aimed at a future state of affairs, which you prefer. That's called psychic profit. And it could be monetary profit or it could be psychic profit, but in general, it's profit, right? All action is aimed at the future and it's aimed at making profit, right? And when you do that, if you live in a market economy, you can use monetary prices to help compare the different projects that are possible and to compare which ones are worth doing and which ones cost more, which ones have more input factors and things like that. That's why a monetary economy is more efficient than a barter society, because you have in a catalactic society, you have the possibility of economic calculation, right? But the point is, some projects are less efficient and less profitable than others, and some are not profitable at all. Like, you would be at a loss, so you don't do it. So if someone says, well, if you have your way in your free market, there are some projects that are just not worth investing in because you would not make enough profit to justify the cost of doing it. Well, what's the answer? Well, then don't do it. I mean, that's a good thing, not a bad thing, that you learn that there's something you shouldn't do. So if you tell me, well, there's a drug that I could make that would cost $75 trillion, but it's just not going to be, it's not going to happen in the free market because no one can ever recoup that much cost. Isn't that a shame that we're not making the $75 trillion drug? I don't think it's a shame, because there's nothing in the law of nature saying we have to have that drug at all costs. Just like it's nothing in the law of nature saying we have to go to Mars or go to Alpha Centauri at the cost of everything on the human race.
Yes, putting it in this way, I think it's so pity the way you frame it, that wealth is just a preferable, more preferable state or of things. It deflates completely the notion of degrowth and not seeking wealth. All the people obsessed with criticizing the pursuit of capitalism, of capitalizing, of improving your well-being by becoming richer, are they advocating for a less preferable state? What the fuck? It's just ridiculous once you frame it in that way and you boil it down to the first principles. It's utterly ridiculous. But so now I wanted to touch on some... Do you know how in exactly connecting to your last intervention, do you know how when a product gets produced the first time, the cost of production is very high, and later in every product, really, there's a reduction in the cost of production as the economy of scale has been created and the people who are poorer benefit a lot from the innovation that has been created by the richer people who were paying for the high cost of the first units. This happens with smartphones, with pharmaceuticals, with televisions, with absolutely everything. This is what happens. How do you see this process happening? And ultimately, it depends on the caprice of the rich people that they want things sooner, right?
Right. I think there's a couple of things here that you could unpack. So number one, when a new product or service is introduced in the economy, and if it's successful, in other words, it satisfies a need that had not been satisfied before, that's when profit is possible. Profit tends to decline over time for two reasons. Well, number one, it doesn't decline as much as you would think, because in fact, you could say all things being equal, profit will grow. Because you learn more, you have economies of scale, as you mentioned, and you also learn more and you refine your techniques and you improve your efficiency over time. So in a sense, your costs are only going to go down over time if you have a successful product, which means your profit will even increase. But initially, your profit is higher than it could be facing a lot of competition because you're the only supplier of a good. So even if your costs are going down and your profit would tend to increase, at the same time, the signals, you're sending signals into the market, a profit and loss signals, like, oh, this is what people should do to compete with me. So you attract competition. So in a sense, profit is an unnatural thing, which is why, you know, in Austrian economics, I guess in the equilibrium is towards there's no profit at all. I mean, profit is an unnatural thing in a sense, right? Everything goes to the interest rate. But in the real world, there is profit because it takes a while for people to compete. But the point is, you always draw competition, which means that if you have an initial profit, it is always going to tend to get eroded because you always face competition. So that's why there's always an incentive to keep innovating. To talk about incentives, there's a natural incentive to keep innovating to stay ahead of your competitors, which the consumers benefit from. So tying into the other point, I suppose lots of luxury goods or expensive goods, like, a customized cure for cancer, or even plastic surgery, let's say, something like that, or luxury cars, right? Or air conditioning, maybe in the beginning. Things that are done because the rich can afford to pay obscene amounts of money for it. Yeah, like you said, the cost of production goes down over time because of expansion economies of scale, and because we learn more and more about how to do it at mass production and efficiency. So of course that benefits the consumers, even if the rich people don't like it. I mean, I think there's a constant tendency for the wealthy to like being at the head, you know, at the top of the pyramid, just psychologically. Like, I think there's something to the idea that, when compact discs became popular in the 1980s, I recall, they started replacing LPs. They were so much better. Like, the quality was like 100% fidelity. But what that meant was, before that point in time, the really wealthy people could afford these $10,000 granite turntables, and they could get like the best sound, and your average guy was getting much inferior sound, right? So they sort of like having the better, like, same thing with cars. They could get a Rolls Royce or a Mercedes, and then your average guy's getting a junky Toyota. Well, when the CDs came along, it equalized. I mean, it made so now the rich people didn't have better sound, and that kind of annoyed them, I think. So then they started doing things like, they bought a super expensive CD player. They put green markers on it, and they put weights on it. They said, I've got super filters, and they were just trying to stand out above the average person. And nowadays, everyone has an airbag and anti-lock brakes and Bluetooth in their cars. They're all really safe. I mean, the rich people still have the Rolls Royces and Mercedes, but they're not really that much better, you know? And now commercial air, everyone can fly. Every middle-class person can get an airline ticket and fly to Disneyland or something like that. You know, they're doing all these things that all these benefits always eventually filter down to the masses, which is good. It's analogous a little bit to this effect of the Hayekian idea of the fund of experience. Like, we are benefiting from the innovative work of our past generations, right? The Romans and everyone between them and us. We benefit from that. I mean, you know, we can use calculus now. We can use knowledge of how to get to launch a rocket ship and to use Wi-Fi and to use computers and cell phones and networks and you know, all these advances. We're benefiting greatly from all that. It's free. In a sense, it's free to us. We're lucky that we've been born when we have been. And by the same token, the benefits that accrue to the wealthy in the beginning, they eventually filter down to the masses. And in fact, of course, that's one reason why the producers do this. They're doing it to test the market and to refine their product and to eventually expand it to sell it to everyone. Like, they want to make money. So it's going to reach the masses eventually.
Yes. A second question I had related to this is whether purchasing power-based pricing would make any sense, but you're already responding to that with an implicit no, because why should I charge you less for being in a poorer country when that would distort the incentives? People would try to play with this newly created politics by creating a VPN from Argentina so that they can subscribe to my Netflix for cheaper, or all kinds of fuckery that emerges from this discrimination based on purchasing power, or that if you create a level playing field for everyone pays the same amount, the same grams of gold for this product, no matter where you come from, then it would make the question I had prepared here, are purchasing power-based pricing the right approach for this kind of international global commerce? Because if you're not going to sell something to a person from Mali for the same price that you're going to sell it to someone from Missouri. So are you supposed to sell them for less? Well, if the marginal cost of production is less, it will be produced for less. But it doesn't make sense to offer the same product, which has costed you the same, to the poorer person for less.
Well, I mean, you could never tell what strategies might work for an entrepreneur. It might make sense to sell at a loss to some markets. I mean, it's called a loss leader. But of course, there's nothing wrong with price discrimination in general. It's just that it's difficult to get away with, just like it's difficult to have a cartel. There's nothing wrong with cartels or with monopoly, with attempts to monopolize or collude. It's just that it's difficult to get away with a cartel because there's competition and there's cheating, right? But price discrimination is any seller of any good wants to maximize his profit and would like to price discriminate. That is, he would like to know what his buyer is willing to pay. And if there's a very rich guy that really wants something, he will sell it to him for a higher price. And if there's someone who wants it for who will not pay as much, I will lower my price as long as I can still make a profit. People, that's natural. People do that all the time, but they can only get away with it so much because the bigger the market, the more they're selling. You can't just, you can't always do that. And it also angers people if they start feeling like they're cheated. So there's always natural limits how much you can get away with. Now, if there's geographically different regions, like if I'm selling an iPhone in the US as opposed to India, I don't know, somewhere like that, then they simply have less wealth and they can't pay as much. So I have to lower the price. So as long as I'm making but the problem is if I lower it too much, then in a free market, there's arbitrage. That's the other limit. So if I sell a textbook in one country for $10 and $90 in America, then someone will do arbitrage. But the problem is tariffs and not totally free trade policies and copyright and patent are the impediments to this. So I'll give you a couple of examples. Number one is there was a case years ago where Wiley, this textbook seller, they would sell expensive textbooks in the US and then they would sell an authorized legitimate version in India on cheaper paper, but it was still the same book, but for like 10% of the price. And you had this college student, he just would go home to India and he would take suitcases of these books back home and sell them in America. That's arbitrage. Now, that's a normal thing on the free market would permit that. But Wiley sued for copyright infringement, saying that because of a quirk in copyright law, that when you sell a book in the US, you can't complain if someone resells it or loans it to a library. Although the publisher tried to stop that decades ago, but they failed. So there's called the exhaustion doctrine or the first sale doctrine. Once you sell a book, you can't, the buyer can sell it to someone else and then the copyright goes along with it. You can't make copies, but at least it's not copyright infringement to sell a copy. But Wiley argued that there's an exception to that because if it was done overseas, then the US copyright law doesn't cover overseas. And so it's a fresh act of copyright infringement, blah, blah, blah. I think they lost, but the point is it's things like that that stop it. Now in the patent and pharmaceutical context, what you have is this weird, so this is not a free market situation, not in America, not in Europe, and not in Canada, because you have socialized medicine in Canada and Europe, and you have the FDA in America, and you have the patent system in America. So these are not free market situations at all. They're heavily distorted by the existence of the patent system, the FDA, and tariffs, and socialized medicine, and all this stuff. But what you have is, you have big American pharmaceuticals selling a drug in the US at a high price, inflated for several reasons. Number one, because they have a patent on it, so they have no competition, so they can just jack up the price. And number two, it's subsidized by Medicare, Medicaid, and by the pharmaceutical industry, by the prescription system. The doctor has to prescribe it. The whole thing is not a free market, but it leads to high prices because of the patent system and other reasons. But you have patents like in Canada, but they also have socialized medicine. And because the government has more control of the economy and they have socialized medicine and the government's paying for all these drugs, they impose price caps. So they say that you can only sell this drug here, say at 10% of the price in the US. I don't even know if it's a price cap or it's just they refuse to buy, the monopsony buyer only buys it at a certain price. But the point is, the US pharmaceutical companies are willing to sell it at 10% of the price in Canada because they still make a profit because the marginal cost is very low. So they're still making a profit, but it's much less. So of course, what's the natural response to this? Arbitrage. Just go to Canada, buy up you're not violating the patent because it's a licensed drug. It's being sold legally there by the seller. It's just that it's being approved by the Canadian FDA. So it's the same thing. It's a safe drug. So all you have to do is have free trade. As long as you have free trade, then you can arbitrage, and that would limit the ability to price discriminate in this way. So that's what Donald Trump's trying to do right now, by the way, by his tariffs. He's trying to tell these other companies, countries, he's trying to say the U.S. Medicare and Medicaid will only pay a certain amount for patented drugs. And so if if the pharmaceutical company is giving a better deal to some socialized system in Europe, then we get the same deal. So he's hoping that will require the prices to be raised that are being paid in Germany, let's say, but also lower in the U.S. So they're the same. So, but this all just because of lack of free trade and because of the patent system. And so anyway, the point is, you had this incident about 15, 17 years ago where the libertarians who are in favor of patents, like Richard Epstein and Doug Bandow and a couple other, I think Michael Krauss at the Cato Institute, were opposing what's called reimportation, which is basically what we call free trade. Like, they didn't want it to be legal to go to Canada and buy these pharmaceuticals at a cheaper price and bring them home, because that would make it harder for the pharmaceutical companies to sell them at a monopoly price here. So when they were forced to choose between free trade, which is a bedrock libertarian principle, and the patent system, they chose the patent system, right? Now, the other people at Cato, in response to this, this caused an uproar by me and others. They were put in their place by Ed Crane and the head. They said, no, we got to favor free trade no matter what, even if it makes it harder to enforce a patent here. But the point is, the market is so distorted by these patents. You have people like Bernie Sanders, and they're all complaining about the price of healthcare. None of them are against the patent system. Why doesn't just one of them say, hey, one reason we could lower medical costs, healthcare costs, is by getting rid of the patent system? And then pharmaceutical prices would drop, they would plummet. No one suggests that. No one.
Yes, of course. It's hard to convince a man of something if his salary depends on his not understanding it.
Correct. Upton Sinclair.
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned in your book Andrew Joseph Columbus. Could you give a short explanation of who he was and what he thought and where his ideas are?
Among libertarians, I would say until around in 1989 or so, when Tom Palmer and Wendy McElroy and Sam Congdon started writing on this, and then later me and others like Roderick Long when the internet happened, I would say most libertarians just kind of assumed intellectual property was legitimate because it's in the Constitution. Like, the U.S. Constitution says that Congress has the power to, you know, encourage artistic creation and inventions with patent and copyright law. So everyone sort of assumed it was part of capitalism. And like I say, nowadays, I'd say most principled libertarians realize it's a big mistake. But in the beginning, there was a group of libertarians and free market types who were just generally in favor of it just because it was in the Constitution or it was part of what they saw as capitalism, or because they accepted the kind of the utilitarian case that, oh, we need to incentivize and encourage innovation and stuff like that. But you had a subset of libertarians who had a more extreme case for IP. Now, one was Ayn Rand. She basically said that patents are the most important right of all. Like, every other right flows from that. And that's because of her confusion about this issue we brought up earlier, which is that creation is a source of property rights, which is not. She's right that the mind is important in all of this, but it doesn't mean that you own what you patterns of information that you come up with. So her case for IP was critical to her whole philosophy, but at least she still believed in finite terms for patent and copyright. So 17 years for patents, 70, whatever it was, 50 years, something for copyright. But she believed in finite terms, so she tried to come up with a reason for that. But there were some other guys like Columbus, also G. Neil Shulman and some other guys who Columbus took what Rand did, because Rand said patents are the heart and core of property rights. But Columbus basically said they're the only or the main form of property. He called it like primary property. Like, your fundamental property is in your ideas. And then everything else is a derivative of that. I mean, it's just crazy. But because he believed that, he was a crazy kook, culty kind of guy. He had this weird, he was like the libertarian version of L. Ron Hubbard, you know, the Dianetics guy and the Scientology guy. He had this crazy, he thought Thomas Paine wrote the Declaration of Independence. He was just one of these weird engineers who thought he knew more than he did about philosophy. But His argument was that there's primary property, which is your ideas, and number one, so your primary property, which is your ideas, should number one last forever. So there's no expiration. Which, by the way, if we had an IP system like that, the human race would be dead because you couldn't do anything at this point. Because there's like thousands of years of permission you need to get to do anything, to pick an apple, to use fire, to light a fire. I mean, use a telescope, use glasses, bifocals, whatever. I mean, we wouldn't be able to act. We would all die out.
But it goes deeper than that. That you mentioned in one of your speeches, in your debate with Corey, I don't remember who was the person you did that debate with, you mentioned a quote of, life is what replicates, and what doesn't replicate is what is dead. What doesn't copy is dead, by definition. So all the adaptations that we have, the shape of my eye, every fact of my body has been selected for, in the same way that in the brain of an engineer, that the right ideas are selected for. So there's only natural selection, variation and selection at every level of an analysis, and you stop the replication from happening.
Yes,
you kill everything. So I don't know what Columbus was thinking about.
Yeah, and by the way, that's Cory Doctorow, who is he's a lefty kind of. So the problem with Cory Doctorow is he had those good insights about what life is, and he's a skeptic of IP and copyright. Not a skeptic like me. I mean, he open sources his books and things like that. But he's not against patent and copyright because he's a socialist and he doesn't have a clear understanding. He believes in socialized medicine, for example. So he doesn't have a principled understanding of property rights. So of course he's not against patent and copyright in principle. So you have all these guys that are reformers like Alex Tabarrok and I think Tyler Cowen, I can't remember, but they always act like they're big mavericks and they want to reform the system, but they're not against patent and copyright. I mean, even people like Michael Humer and David Friedman, you think of them as radical anarchist thinkers, they don't have a clear case against patent and copyright because they don't think in the same type of Austro-libertarian principle terms as we do. Anyway, Galambos, he took his ideas to such lengths that not only were intellectual property rights, patent and copyright, did they last forever, but they're also inalienable. And they were so inalienable that whoever owned it couldn't even transfer it to someone else, which meant that if Andrew Galambos could not be reached or after he died, then his followers couldn't even tell people about his amazing ideas because they couldn't get his permission anymore. I mean, like the whole thing is self-defeating, right? So that's one reason you never hear about Galambos is because his followers, they take him seriously, can't tell people what his ideas were. There's a funny book by Jerome Ticilli called It Usually Begins with Ayn Rand, where he has a hilarious parody. I don't know if it's a parody. It sounds almost true to me because I've met some of these guys of Galambos. But the point is, if you really take these things seriously, then you would snuff out life in the world, as Cory Doctorow kind of senses in his comment that you pointed to.
Exactly. I'm preparing right now an essay to be co-published with Louis Rossman about all the different levels at which entitification happens and how to fight it, and the dishonest work that happens with big platforms and big tech, which can be fought through open source software like Linux or good web browsers that respect privacy or ad blockers. And maybe the two double punch approach that we're trying to deliver with this article, by giving the general principle by which my ideas or the ideas that we are defending are right, are accompanied by the second punch, which is the practical thing. What do you have to do to get what is actually the thing making the difference? You getting less surveilled by big tech, you being more of a sovereign user of technology. Maybe you could do something similar. And I don't know if I'm being completely a fool here because it would be counterproductive for you. But if you think that copyright shouldn't be respected, Anna's Archive exists. That's an incredible source of ebooks that one can use. Have you thought about the ethics of sharing this kind of resource?
Yeah, sure. I have. And I think that, look, you can make a case that we live in an imperfect world that's not fully libertarian, but you could make, I don't really believe this exactly myself, but like Randy Barnett and others make, you could make an argument that there's an obligation to obey the law, even if the law is not perfect, because it's just, it's a system we live in, et cetera. You could also make an argument that it's immoral not to give to charity and not to support artists and things like that. Like, but I think it's not unethical at all to violate copyright because there's no agreement. And I do believe with what Benjamin Tucker, the American anarchist from the late 1800s, said that, you know, if you want to keep your ideas to yourself, keep them to yourself. But if you make an idea public, right, it's like he gives the analogy of a man scattering money on the street, just throwing in the air. And if people start taking it, you can't complain about that. Likewise, if you have information, like if you have a novel in your head, or if you come up with an invention in your head, you don't have to tell anyone. But if you want to tell people, which you have to tell people by publishing a book, if you want to make a profit off of your book, you have to spill the beans and say what your story is. Or if you want to sell a mousetrap with an improved feature, you have to sell the mousetrap and they see what the feature is, or you have to tell them what it is. So if you choose to make information public, then you can't complain that people use it. And there's nothing wrong with using it. I mean, I don't think it's immoral at all. So, you know, there are some laws, like laws against robbery and theft. I think those laws are justified laws, and they also identify behavior that is also immoral. So it would be wrong to steal something, and it would be a crime, okay? There are some laws that are crimes that are not immoral, like it's immoral not to pay your taxes. I mean, sorry, it's a crime not to pay your taxes, to be a tax evader. I don't think it's immoral to do that. It might be immoral to evade taxes in a way that gets your family harmed by you going to prison. Like, it might be a prudential thing. Like, maybe it's not wise to evade taxes in certain cases, but it's not immoral. In the sense of violating someone's rights or doing something wrong. Now, when it comes to patent and copyright, I don't think that advocacy or pointing out the problems with it, like I've been doing for 30 years, is going to make any dent in it, because the interests are so entrenched and everyone is so confused in society about this issue because of the Lockean mistake. And because of this labor idea and the creationism, I call it the creationism idea, the idea that like that mistake is so deeply embedded that I don't see anyone ever getting that straight. We make a little headway with careful, consistent, principled thinkers in our group of Austro-libertarians, but that's not much. So I don't see any progress for eroding the patent system or copyright system anytime soon, although we do have this coming conflict with artificial intelligence. It's going to become apparent at a certain point that you can't have both very functioning AI and strongly enforced patent and copyright, because one has to give. I'm afraid copyright is going to give a little, but it's not going to give enough. And so AI is going to make it, but it's going to limp along in a gimped fashion, just slower and less efficient than it otherwise would be. However, advocacy won't do the trick. We will not succeed at any time in the near future in abolishing or even restricting patent and copyright. However, as you mentioned with Anna's Archive, the nature of these laws and the reason they're unjustified is because they apply to ideas. And because of that, it becomes harder and harder to police it. So because of the internet and encryption, and cell phones, right? And DRM, not DRM, but just like basically encryption and networking and the internet. Because of that, it's almost impossible to enforce copyright law, which I think is a good thing. So the fact that I think is a good thing means it's not unethical at all. I think it's good to pirate as much as you can. Nothing wrong with it in the slightest. It's just, I just need to be prudential about it. Don't risk going to federal prison unless you really want to. I mean, I wouldn't do it myself. So, but yeah, I see nothing wrong with using pirating resources. So that's the one reason why copyright is hard to enforce. Now, it's still enforced against the big companies like Netflix and Disney and people like that. Of course, they enforce it themselves too. Anyone that a plaintiff can sue in court is going to obey. But your average person who can go anonymously on torrents, yeah, they can't be caught. Now, patents are not quite there yet. And I think patents are actually more important because they're more damaging to the human race, because their patents are what slows down and distorts the development and spread of technological knowledge, right? So I think patents are what is slowing down the advancement of the human race, and so causing, you know, indirectly billions of human immiseration and death and things like that over time. But patents are still enforceable. So I think that hopefully, my hope is that eventually 3D printing will mature enough to where it will start to become a threat to the patent system, because people will be easily able to evade the patent system, just like they can evade it now with copyright. So when 3D printing matures, if it ever does, like if you can ever print a car or print an iPhone in your basement on a 3D printer using pirated, you know, design files, then the patents will be very difficult to enforce, and that will reduce prices and be better for the benefit of the consumer. So I'm hopeful that technology will somewhat liberate us from patents, just like it started to do for copyright.
We've already effectively open sourced software, and we're hoping we will open source hardware. And one of the main arguments in this article that I'm writing is that marginally you can make a difference by yourself opting out of a corrupt system. If you install an ad block, you are distributing your attention, you're moving it from a corrupt system of information harvesting, advertising, serving business model towards a one based on subscription and direct monetization, which is a much more legitimate one without hidden costs to you in terms of privacy or bullshit pop-ups that you didn't agree on. So I think that pirating and would make the floor of the market. It's like a competition. If you offer me as Netflix a bullshit service, I will find the torrent and I won't consume your product. And the more available it is, the more of an incentive there is for them to improve their product.
Well, it's a little bit like the reason we talked about earlier about price discrimination. One reason it's hard to price discriminate is because of the existence of bargain shoppers. So in a sense, the wealthy and the middle classes are benefited by the cheapness of the poor people, because they will look for a deal everywhere they can. Like they will go to thrift stores, they'll wait for the sales. But because the companies selling the goods know that these people exist, it makes it hard for them to raise prices too much. So in a sense, prices are lower than they would be for the benefit of the rich, because of the actions of the poor always looking for a deal, right? And by the same token, the existence of people willing to pirate can put limits on the monopoly rates charged by the legitimate companies like Netflix. Now, in my personal sort of view as a member of society and as a regular human and as a libertarian, I like to distinguish between activism. So I think that's fine to view that as a type of activism, just like using Bitcoin, right? Using Bitcoin, trying to onboard people onto it, using encryption in your emails, getting pirated books. You could view all that as a type of activism, or carrying a weapon, you know, when you're permitted to. All that can be viewed as a type of activism, and that's fine. I don't think there's any particular duty to make your life more unpleasant if you don't need to. I mean, if you can do it, do it. If you want to do it, that's fine. But I kind of think that liberty and things that work in the long run have to be based upon the inherent qualities of the thing. In other words, if liberty is going to be achieved, right, or if we're going to get rid of copyright, it's not going to be because a few libertarians are subverting the ability of the process. It's good that they do it, but it's mostly because there's just a financial incentive for people to save money by using an easy to find torrent, right? Or encrypted file of a pirated file of a movie or of a book.
Those are
or
not
whatever.
Different. Those are the same thing.
They can be, but your average person is not doing it for ideological reasons, right? They're just doing it. They're doing it in response to the fact that it's easier to evade the system, which is good.
Yes, but I think that I'm sorry, this interview might be going for longer than it should have been, but just let me make a last comment. Parasitism is a law of nature, and it will always be with us. So the next copyright will be invented whenever this thing gets overcome. So I think that in habilitating the antibodies or spreading the knowledge of the antibodies, so there's the pathogen, Netflix in this case, serving you something that's parasitic because they benefit more than they should in the opinion of the people who go against the copyright. And there's the antibody against it. You pirate it with torrents so that you don't pay for it. That dynamic of coevolution will always be there. And I think when we, even if we put into law that copyright shouldn't exist and patents shouldn't exist, they will invent the next thing. They will force you to use their device to play their video at a certain frame rate so that you cannot record it with some cameras. I don't know what they will do, but they will figure out something. And so I think that given that this is an eternal coevolution between the parasite and the host, giving the host the most weapons possible is the way to go. Because you're right, it will never go away. But what can happen is the marginal change. If we get more people to opt out of the system, the effective effect, the effective relevance of the patents and the copyright will be less. So we are effectively delawing them, eliminating them from law because they have less effect.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, I think that the one way to look at it is that this natural process of parasitism and host or whatever you want to call it. The problem is the copyright and patent law exist and gives them much more ability to engage in that behavior than they otherwise would. So our counterattack, in a sense, is to sort of use agorist or whatever you want to call it, agorist techniques to sort of fight against it. Like that's the way we fight against it, is we do end runs around the system, in a sense. And by the way, I've written a little booklet. Jeffrey Tucker published it under, I think it was under Liberty.me when he was doing that years ago. It's called Do Business Without Intellectual Property. So it's sort of like a concise little booklet, a guide to the way the real world is, the reason people sometimes use intellectual property, even if they're opposed to it. But an understanding of when you really need to and when you could really reduce your use, when you could reduce your dependence on it and your use of it, if you wanted to push more in that direction of not using it, when you can avoid it. So that's called Do Business Without Intellectual Property. So that's a little bit pushing in the direction you're talking about, like don't pay Netflix a fee, pirate instead. I'm saying, well, don't support the existing IP system when you don't really need to.
Exactly. Amen. And thank you very much, Stephen Kinsella. It's been a great pleasure talking with you. I've been a longtime follower of your work. And in Spain, there's Juan Ramon Rayo, who got me into your book. I don't know if you happen to know him, but he's one of the most well-known libertarians in Spain. So thank you very much for this conversation, Stephen.
Enjoyed it. Thanks so much.